For those of you who are in the practice period, know that Eshu is the Shuso during this practice period, and he's graciously agreed to share the teacher's seat for these next few weeks. And so we are going to be tag teaming on the Dharma talks as we look at this really beautiful and brief little essay of Dogen's on how to become a bodhisattva, really. And for those of you who are not in the practice period, I just want to really welcome you in. This is a period of about 4 weeks where we're taking a little time out of our normal everyday lives and entering into what we call the peaceful abode, the peaceful dwelling place of being in each other's company, and to rest a bit in the Dharma teachings and to allow it to kind of cultivate some new questions for us, to restore us, to have us expand our imaginations and how we might return out into the complicated world that all of us occupy. So we covered a lot of that on Sunday, just welcoming everyone into the practice period. And tonight, we're going to transition from some of the themes of how to hold a practice period into some of the themes of this text. And we're going to do that by having these Dharma talks that Eshu and I share. And the way we go about this is we actually don't talk to each other very much about how we're going to approach the Dharma talk. So I'm going to go first tonight, which lucky me, because then I don't have to adjust or adapt anything, and Eshu will follow. And he has also prepared some thoughts. And we see, and we enter into a little bit of a Dharma tango, a Dharma dance, and we get to explore our practice from a couple of different perspectives at the same time. So this is a wonderful thing. And we need to check something. And if you're, yeah, I guess if you're unmuted, just be sure to mute yourself, okay? Because we can hear some sound on this end. And we will have on Thursdays a kind of forum in the afternoon at about 3 o'clock, I think, Eastern time, where we will talk about the text and have more conversation about it. So we're each going to speak for about 20 minutes, and that'll take us pretty close to the end of the time. And you know, if there's a burning question, of course we'll take it, but we will kind of hold off on Dharma discussion until we have our forum tomorrow night. Okay, so that's how this is going to go each week during the Dharma talk. And on Sunday, I want to kind of use Sunday's talk as a bit of a jumping off point. I had told one of my favorite Dharma stories from Dogen, where he mentions that at the end of a practice period, Manjushri shows up out of the blue after having been hanging out during the practice period at a wine shop, at a brothel, and at a butcher shop, all the forbidden things. That's where he went in the practice period. And he was about to be expelled from the Sangha. But then, as soon as he was going to be expelled, a million Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and ancestors show up, and Mahakashapa is challenged to figure out which of any of these are real or fake Buddhas. And the point of that lesson is, it's an invitation, I think, from Dogen for all of us to bring every aspect of ourselves into the practice period, to not leave anything out, to not conceal anything about our lives from ourselves or from the practice, to let the light of this practice period shine on all of it, even if we're kind of embarrassed about it. And this idea shows up a lot in Buddhist teachings, and it's often put, this kind of teaching is often put in the mouth of Manjushri, which is so interesting, the Bodhisattva of wisdom. That it's the Bodhisattva of wisdom that's reminding us over and over again that we can bring our whole selves, even the parts of ourselves that exist in the shadow. And so this little passage, I think Dogen must have gotten it from a number of places, but it's written about extensively in a wonderful ancient sutra called the Vimalakirti Sutra, which was probably written in Pali in about the first century, the modern era in the West. And it shows up in China, the earliest versions of it, in about the fourth or fifth century. So very, very old. And it's a wonderful sutra that I hope someday we're going to study here. It's about a lay person named Vimalakirti. And the Buddha and Manjushri see Vimalakirti as this incredibly wise person and very skillful. So in the middle of the Vimalakirti Sutra, Manjushri is found to say these words, and I'm going to have a little extended excerpt from the sutra. Manjushri says, "Ignorance and partiality are the seeds of Buddhahood. Greed and anger and our stupidity are the seeds of Buddhahood. These are the seeds of enlightenment. The four topsy-turvy views are the seeds. The five obscurations are the seeds. The six sense media are the seeds. The seven abodes of consciousness are the seeds. The eight errors are the seeds. The nine sources of anxiety are the seeds." I can count more than nine in my life, but anyway, he says the nine sources of anxiety are the seed. The 10 evil actions are the seed. To sum it up, Manjushri says, the 62 erroneous views and all the different kinds of earthly desires are all the seeds of Buddhahood. And Mahakashyapa, the person who also shows up in Dogen's little story, says, "What do you mean by that, Manjushri?" And this is clearly where Thich Nhat Hanh gets his beautiful a formulation of no mud, no lotus. Manjushri replies, "The lotus does not grow on the upland plain. The lotus grows in the mud and the mire of damp and low-lying places. If you plant seeds in the sky, they will not grow. Only when you plant them in the well-manured soil can they sprout and flourish. If you do not descend into the vast ocean, you can never acquire the priceless pearl. It's the same way. If you do not enter the great sea of earthly desires of your human life, you can never acquire the treasure of comprehensive wisdom." And Mahakashyapa at this point sighs, as kind of I do right there, like, ah, and says, "Indeed, it is just as you say. This is the way." So this is a really important part of our practice, that we're not here to show up as these perfect beings, but we show up unconcealed and we reveal ourselves. And this is the seed of our Buddhahood. And I share all that because I want to emphasize, as we move through this practice period, that the bodhisattva heart, the theme that we have, the theme of this very practice period, the heart of the bodhisattva comes from the messiness of our humanity. And how we look at the messiness and the mud, and the methods that we use to deal with the messiness and the muck and the mud, is the very method of becoming a bodhisattva, right? So we have to, if we're interested in becoming bodhisattvas, then we have to bring it all in. The first way that we begin to look at that muck and mud and the messiness, and the way we begin to work with it is, according to Dogen, and to many teachers before Dogen ever wrote these words, but for them, the way we work with it is through this quality of giving, of generosity, which is the first of the four methods that Dogen writes about as a way to become a bodhisattva. And this is what the Buddha taught as well. There's a very ancient text where a student asks the Buddha, "What's the method of training for those who seek enlightenment?" And the Buddha gives a list of six things. You may have heard of them as the perfections or the paramitas, And the first on that list is generosity. Followed then, only after generosity, is it followed by morality or ethics and patience and energy and meditation and wisdom. But generosity is the beginning point of the whole practice. And almost everybody since the Buddha has agreed that the method of training starts with the work of giving. So it's not surprising that our friend Dogen starts with this list of giving and gives it a central place in our practice. It's actually the piece he writes about the most in this essay. And so he says to us, and you know, there's a lot that he says there, but I'm going to pull out just a couple little things. He says, when we carefully learn the meaning of giving, both receiving a body and giving up your body, which means your whole life, becomes the offering. When you carefully learn the true meaning of giving, your whole life becomes the offering. So why is there this heavy, heavy emphasis on generosity and giving in so much of Buddhist literature? And I have a theory about it. And I think it's for two interrelated reasons that this becomes so important to our practice. The first is, it's impossible to conceive of generosity as something that you do alone. Generosity, by definition, requires a giver and a receiver and a gift. And there are lots and lots of teachings that talk about how unclear and blurry that line, those lines are between who's giving, who's receiving, and what the gift is, because the practice of generosity is this incredible practice of mutuality among things. So that's one reason. And the second reason, I think, is that generosity requires a set of decisions on our part, a set of choices that we have to make. So it's a choice, just like becoming a bodhisattva is a choice that we can make. And many of us are trying to make that choice right here by practice. And it's interesting here because, you know, we often say, well, you're already a Buddha, right? You're already a Buddha. You already have a Buddha heart. And Dogen doesn't write in this essay about how to become a Buddha. He's talking about how to become a bodhisattva, because that there's a method to that. There's work. We have to cultivate this bodhisattva heart throughout our lives in order to manifest bodhisattvahood in our lives. Buddhahood is always there. And now we're trying to work on these qualities of being a bodhisattva. And he says that we have to work on changing our minds, changing the way we see things, changing the way we think, changing the way our minds are often oriented in order to become a bodhisattva, that it requires us to change our minds. And, you know, this is not surprising, right? That we have to change our minds from having a greedy mind to having a generous mind. I mean, that's like apple pie. We all can agree with that. It's wonderful. It tastes good. It's a spiritual teaching, probably from every different tradition, religious tradition around the world, right? Of course, we have to change our minds. We have to change from being self-oriented and self-centered into being selfless and other-oriented. But he also reminds us, as he says that we have to change our minds, that changing the mind of a sentient being is a very difficult thing, he says. The mind of a sentient being is a difficult thing to change, he says in this essay. And that gives us a hint of the work that it takes, that we have to do to become a bodhisattva. And we can think about this technically, I guess. You know, if I were to ask you to fold your arms just like you always do, you would fold them in a certain way. Like, you can go ahead and do that if you want. You can fold your arms in a certain way, just as you always would. And then if I asked you to change and fold your arms in the opposite direction, it takes a little effort, doesn't it? It takes just a little bit of effort to do it a little differently. And this is what makes the practice kind of challenging, is we're trying to do things differently than we habitually do. And so when we choose to become a bodhisattva, we are choosing to like fold our arms in a different way. We're choosing to see the world and our life in a little bit different way than the way we've been taught and instructed to see it by our history, by our culture, right? By all the things that we've taken in to our lives. We're trying to have a new way of seeing and being. But in some ways, changing the habit of change of your arms folding is even easier than I think what Dogen is talking about when he says changing the mind of a sentient being is a different thing, is a difficult thing. I think it's even more difficult for us to face the task of constructing a life for ourselves, constructing a bodhisattva life for ourselves. It's very difficult for us to ask the questions, how shall I live my life? What kind of person do I really want to be? What kind of society do I want to create, and will I commit to making? And these require choices. The answers to these questions require choices, and some of them are very difficult to make. In the abstract, these may be easy questions to chat about over tea with a friend, but down in the details, when we confront the truth of, as Dogen says, giving up the body, the truth of our impermanence, the truth that one day we will face the end of this life, these questions become much harder. What will you do with your life? What have you done with your life? Not necessarily in the big, large strokes, but down in the details. Word by word, how do you live your life? Action by action, how do you live your life? Moment by moment, how do you live your life? And these are the questions that are all through Dogen's essay here, as he looks at speech and action and identity. How will you live your life? So I don't know, I have to confess, on Sunday I made a confession, I'm going to make another confession tonight. Sometimes I binge watch Netflix. It's like mind candy. It must be like an intoxicant or something. It takes me away, like a bubble bath or something. And I don't know if you all watch Grace and Frankie. This is the odd little comedy that's been on for seasons now on Netflix, where Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin are together as best friends, and they're growing old together. And they have these gay husbands who fall in love, and now they're left with each other's friendship, yada, yada, yada. It's a kind of mindless thing. But this is the last season. And so, as I binged watched the other night, the Lily Tomlin character begins to confront her own mortality. She's told she's going to die at a certain time. A fortune teller tells her. And she begins to ask all kinds of big questions. As she's approaching 80 or some odd years old, what has my life been about? So she goes into a kind of existential crisis about this when she begins to face the truth and the reality and the inevitability of sickness and old age and death. What have I done with my life? She keeps asking. What's my legacy for my family, for the people I love, for my community, for the planet? And in the end, she realizes that her legacy is not hers alone to hand off for the future. That her legacy is actually the relationships that keep her own bodhisattva life alive and going in the world. It's kind of simple and beautiful little expression of this little thing that I think Dogen is talking about. So I think in this teaching, generosity is not left to chance. What Dogen is saying is we have to practice giving, that we have to use giving as a way to sculpt how we want to be in relationship with others. That we're all challenged to get clearer and clearer over the course of our lives about what gift from our lives we're going to be giving. How do I want to give it? And how will I receive the gifts that others give me? And this becomes a deep, mindful practice as we go through life. How are we doing for time? Do I have about 5-10 more minutes? So for Buddhists, this is a really good opportunity for us. That this is, in fact, the primary and opportunity, and I think responsibility that humans have, which is to really consider how we co-create in an endless loop of connections with each other, with ourselves, with the world, how we co-create the world we really want, the people we really want to be, through giving. What kind of giving do we want to engage in that shapes us and shapes our world? What do we want to be giving to one another? And this is where the muck that Manjushri talks about, I think, becomes so important. Because we get clearer and clearer about the opportunities and the choices, the decisions ahead of us, as we reflect deeply on where we've made less than perfect choices in the past, that we learn as we keep going through the practice. And this is part of what makes it a continuous practice, that the path itself, the continuous nature of the path of learning and reflecting and then adjusting and making a new choice, is in fact enlightenment. And this is what the great Prajnaparamita Sutras tell us, that the path itself is enlightenment, and that to make the path is a process of co-creation, our relationship with all other things, with one another. Path making is enlightenment. And many of us who practice Zen, of course, are very committed to a practice of Zazen. And in the teachings, and I think in experience as we practice Zazen more and more, we begin to see Zazen itself as an expression of giving and receiving. We receive, some teachers say, we receive in Zazen, Zazen mind, a mind that is not cut off from anything else. So again, Zazen, like giving, isn't done alone. It's impossible. The mind of Zazen is a mind that's not cut off from anything else, a mind that's aware that it's in a constant exchange with all beings, just like generosity. The mind is not cut off. The mind is not grasping. The mind is not greedy. Dogen says, giving means not being greedy. Even if we rule the continents, even if we have everything we could ever imagine, ever wanting, that in order to offer the true teachings of the Dharma, we must simply and unfailingly not be greedy or graspy. So when we practice, we're not being greedy. When we practice Zazen, we're doing it in the spirit of generosity, where we open ourselves to receiving the gifts of everything that's in motion and unfolding, moment to moment to moment to moment. And we give ourselves over to all the many things that are changing and that we're interrelating with over and over and over, moment by moment by moment. We're giving and receiving in Zazen. So receiving the mind of Zazen is one method of becoming a bodhisattva, resting in this mind that's not cut off from anything else, receiving this sense of belonging. And in receiving that sense of belonging in Zazen, we then can offer belonging to others by means of our speech and our words and our actions. And so this is why Dogen puts generosity first, because it's the place of that sense of belonging, from which all other action arises. And so this isn't a theoretical thing. Sometimes we can get a little romantic about this idea of generosity and giving, but Dogen takes us back to like concrete things. He says it begins with concrete acts of giving, and then it kind of gets into our bones and it perfumes our every thought, right? But it begins with something concrete. This is how concrete he gets. He says, to provide a boat or build a bridge is offering as the practice of giving. When we carefully learn the meaning of giving, this is that line before, both receiving our body and giving up our body, birth and death, your life itself, are the offerings. Earning our livelihood or managing our businesses from the outset are nothing other than giving. He even begins to get poetic. This is where it perfumes our lives. Trusting flowers to the wind and trusting birds to the seasons may also be the meritorious acts of giving, right? He's painting a little picture for us that it's concrete and it's always happening. We also learn in this text that giving is not necessarily just transactional. Right, we've seen that in the long history of giving, haven't we? That if you give something, you get something in return, you've kind of done your duty to do your giving. I know in some of the places I've been, even religiously, like times in Catholicism, I've found that it was just your duty to give, you know, or the tithing mind or things like that. You just give. And there's real value in that. But I think we also are pushing forward beyond just transactional giving. Mother Teresa, since I mentioned Catholicism, I'll mention Mother Teresa. Mother Teresa got down to the heart of the matter here when she said, it's not how much we do, but how much love we put in the doing. It's not how much we give, but how much love we put into the giving. And Vimalakirti, our old friend now, says something similar. The giver who makes gifts to the lowliest poor of the city, considering them as worthy as the Buddha himself. The giver who gives without discrimination, who gives impartially, who gives with no expectation of reward and with great love. This giver, I say, totally fulfills the perfection of generosity. And also from our tradition, the great Shantideva says that the perfection of generosity resides in the mental attitude of generosity itself. It seeps into our bones and it begins to become the way that we see our lives and see our world and see our relationships through the mental attitude of giving and receiving in gift. And this mental attitude is a choice that we cultivate as a method of becoming a bodhisattva. And this is a constantly implied theme in Dogen's teaching on giving. So concretely, let's talk about what that might mean for us during this week of the practice period. You know, we have a course called the Infinite Circle, and this month, the people in the first year of the Infinite Circle were given a task to practice what I call the generosity experiment. And their job this month is to give every single time they're asked for something, whether it's money or their time or their talent, is to experiment with what it feels like to give every single time you're asked. They need to give away something. It has to be something whenever they're asked. When I've done this in my own life, and I've done it a few times, it's a really interesting little experiment to do with yourself. When I've done this, I've noticed that I wind up asking a lot of questions of myself. Shall I share what I have, or shall I keep it? Shall I give my attention, or shall I withhold it? Shall I turn toward or turn away from the asker? Who and what deserves my time and my talents and my treasures? What am I afraid to give here? What do I make of my failure to give? What happens when I give and I don't hold anything back? And so I'm going to suggest that maybe you too engage in this experiment this week and see what happens to your heart and your mind. If you see where you get stuck and where's the muck and the mud of this question of generosity for you, where does the lotus flower bloom for you in your own practice of generosity? So this week, maybe we can sit with a question and let it kind of blossom in our heart a little bit. What would you give? What would you give to yourself and to others if you thought that what you gave could change the course of human suffering? So we talked about imagination during this practice period. Imagine that. What would you give to yourself and others if what you gave could change the course of human suffering? What would you give? And maybe this is a question to sit with a little bit this week. Okay, so I'm sorry if I went a little bit over time, Aisho. Gonna trade off.
No problem. Am I okay? Can you see me?
Can you see Aisho and can you hear him?
Can you see me? Can you hear me? Because I did my hair specially for today. So I have some notes and I'm just gonna go through the notes and just pick out some things that I want to bring up about this particular essay. There is a historical context to this essay that is meaningful. I'm not into history for history's sake, but there's a bit of a mystery around this essay, a mystery that we thought we solved, but we haven't, because there's lots of fake documents around. But when this essay was written, and it's dated with tomorrow's date, by the way, the 5th of the May, Dogen was on a practice period from the middle of April to the middle of July, but it was a strange practice period. He disappeared last week and went off to see a donor with a revised essay. He reappeared and tomorrow gives this essay. He gives a beautiful essay called Entangling Vines or Tangled Vines in 2 weeks' time. But then at the end of this practice period that we're in now, at the end of it, he just then packs everything up and him and 100 people, monks and lay people, hike for 100 miles over a few days. They go over a 2,000 foot pass and we don't know why. There was a lot going on. He had problems with the other Buddhist sects who weren't too keen on him or were threatening him. He had a donor who was willing to give him some land in the mountains because he feared for his safety. So whilst this practice period was going on and there was some beautiful work, there's nothing in the work or his talks that mention why he suddenly just emptied everything and left. To me, though, that historical context, this is an important essay for me because it brought me into my body when I was a teenager. It's in all of the mess that he was, obviously, there was a lot going on politically and financially and socially. What do I need to say? What's important in all of this? At this time in his life, he was writing some beautiful work. But what was important at this moment? How is it to behave with right form, dignity, and in a correct manner? So there's something here about what Sensei Alan Sanolki in the book that we're looking at as well, The Bodhisattva's Embrace, when he says, can we take a stand that's both kind and strong? Dogen would call it Roshin, grandmother's mind. And Dogen didn't invent these four aspects. They're in the Lotus Sutra, they're around. But he chose them deliberately to send a message. And you can see in the first line, for anyone that's written it, that there's obviously a political and social edge to it. But this fascicle, this essay is that important that there's a teacher called Shohaku Okumura who calls this essay the essence of our practice. When I first came across this essay, I came across these four embracing dharmas as charity, tenderness, benevolence, and sympathy. And sympathy is the word I'll return to later on in the month. With all of the philosophy, the headiness, how do we act as bodhisattvas, to be bodhisattvas, but also what would we expect as an expression of bodhisattva-ness? What would I expect with my practice? What would I expect? So with the practice that you have and I have, how do we think we would act? And how do we think we should act? And Dogen, being Dogen, he also points to these, he doesn't just do the concrete thing with 1, 2, 3, 4, he also points to these as liberation. And I prefer the word liberation for me rather than awakening, because it feels like liberation. And he, throughout this essay, he also talks to that flow of this non-fixed selfing thing. How do we live like this in a relaxed, giving into it way? And the other thing that Dogen has chosen here, he's chosen four things, as Joshin has said, that are relational. They are relational to other and also relational inward as well. So tonight's about giving, and there are a couple of things I want to bring up about this giving thing. And I want to start with the first few words for anyone who's read this. So giving. We know what giving is. I mean, generally we get a sense of giving. And sitting here now, you can probably get a sense of what giving means in your body, what it is to give. And we can deepen that. We can examine our hearts and minds when we give, when we make an offering. And we can perhaps, with our practice, with our meditation, get a sense of the expectation of something in return. Even our own internal self-congratulation that we've given. We get a sense of what giving and what comes with giving means. But that's not how Dogen starts this. Dogen approaches this in a totally different way, straight away in the first half a dozen words. And as I sit here now getting a sense of knowing what giving is, when Dogen says that giving is non-greed, I get a different feel to that. It's no longer about giving. There's a quietening that goes on where giving is just not being greedy. And I'm not sure what other word to use, because greedy's got such a bad press, but there's a quieting down. How do we live in a way where we're giving, where, as Sensei Alan says in the book, that we're not living at the expense of others, where we're just here being non-greedy? We can't get no satisfaction. But not being greedy, there's something that does to that. And I don't mean that because we can't get any satisfaction, we then have to go to, we must sacrifice. It's just that we're not watering those seeds in our practice. If we quieten the giving down a little for a minute, if we quieten down in a way that we can get that sense of not being greedy, then maybe we can get a sense of what our lives would be like if we just stay with that for a minute, with the non-greed bit. How would it be personally, not to be so driven, so constant, wanting to be someone else? We talk about giving all the time, but how about if Dogen, in the first half a dozen words, we followed that in our relationships? What is it like to be just non-greedy, not so demanding, not wanting people to be different because they're not enough, or as Charlotte Drocote Beck says, when they're not quite right, the people in our lives. And the way that Dogen, and we're only on the first six words, so we've got 2 or 3 hours to go yet. We're only the first six words here. But when we look at this non-greed, we can see that giving can be a source of liberation from greed. And that's what comes up in this essay a lot, this liberation, in the way that kind speech can liberate us from anger and hatred. Beneficial action can liberate us from greed and anger. Identity action, or sympathy, as I'm going to use the word, can liberate us from ignorance, the ignorance of having a separate fixed self. So these four practices, including giving, practiced in this way, this particular free way, from our place of interconnectedness, can allow us to be free. And that's my primary emphasis for this 10 minutes that I've got, or 5 minutes. This liberation links to Zazen practice. Because when we have a practice which is based in Zazen, our practice, what we're practicing all the time, is letting go. Not letting go like a balloon off into the sky, but just letting things flow. And this is what is being pointed out as the way that we show giving. It's got a flow to it, a freedom to it, a lightness to it. It's not got all our stuff necessarily attached to it. One thing I ended up with today was the gift of our practice. And I don't know why I've ended up here. Because with giving, we can end up in so many places, and the gift of our practice seems a little self-centered, perhaps. But with that gift of practice comes fearlessness. Traditionally, there are two forms of giving. There's giving of material, and there's giving of dharma. But there's actually three. There's a third one, abhidharma, which is giving of fearlessness. And that's one of the things that actually brought me into practice, was seeing people practice in a way that was fearless. I was used to being with warriors. In my teenage years, my girlfriend was British number one judo champion, so I'm used to fearless people. But when I met people who were practicing with Buddhist practice, when I met monastics, there was a fearlessness there that wasn't aggressive. It was just fierce. They were totally in their practice. And this giving in a fearless way is a different sort of giving that we're used to when we live out in the world. That fearlessness also involves our spiritual practice in organizations. Once we get to a dozen words in this essay, we're talking about currying favor. And there's this thing about being fearless where I can give in a way where I'm not trying to get something in return. I give in a way where I'm not trying to curry favor, where I'm trying to present myself as someone different so I can impress someone. I've got 3 minutes. So I want to end up where I've ended up with this. And it surprised me where I've ended up with this. When I look at giving with Dogen, when giving means that there's a quietening with the heart lens of non-greed, that the way we give, the freeness from all that stuff. And I had a piece I wanted to talk about freeness, but I'll do that another day. The liberation, that certainty, that fearlessness. I find that I end up with you. You and your practice. not someone else in history, not in a book, but you. You in the room, you on the screen. And when I look at giving and Dogen, I had this realization that your practice and how it comes out, how it's lived out in your being is a true gift. Everything I've experienced of people here, everyone on the screen, it's a gift. Our practice, zazen, precepts, paramitas, it's a gift. And I think that before I go, I want to put a special spotlight on that gift of practice and how that can be a gift of fearlessness to others. Your practice is a gift. And this is a way of giving, this particular way of giving that we're talking about, this particular way of giving that we're practicing. This is so needed in the world right now. Thank you.
Thank you, Isha.
Thank you.
Yeah. Beautiful. All right, everyone. So I hope this week you'll sit with this, first of all, with a deeply generous spirit, to really inquire into the power of generosity in the world, in your life, to receive the gift of Zazen and to share it with one another.